Manuel Vasquez is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Vasquez to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. The Execution Watch for Manuel Vasquez begins.
And good evening. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston, the broadcast, and we're on HD1 as well. Or you may be getting us on the internet over executionwatch.org or kpft.org. Ever how you got here, you hear. And unfortunately, we have a serious business of the execution of Manuel Vasquez tonight. If you normally tune in KPFT broadcast for Border Radio, you will find it on KPFT's HD3 channel. And if you don't happen to have an HD radio, you can go to the internet, go to KPFT's website, search the front page for the live streaming of HD3 channel, and you'll find the show you normally hear on broadcast. Execution Watch is not on every week. We're on whenever there's an execution, and we wish we were always preempted with something else, and there were no executions, but when there is one, we're going to be here, and that's just who we are and what we do. Could we find Pat? All right, Pat, you're on the air. Nope, nobody's pushed the button yet. Somebody pushed the button, too. Okay, here. Nope, the other button. Nope, the other button. Pat? There is no Pats. There is Pats. You can put it on hold and then push the correct button, which would be the second line. There you go. Pat, are you there?
Yes, I am, and the witnesses just walked across. He had Manuel had five witnesses go in for him.
Could you tell who they were?
Yes, it was his sister Mary. It was two spiritual advisors, Arturo and Art. It was a old pen pal named Francis and a very, very close childhood friend named Mercedes.
And Francis is from where?
I think she's from Florida. She's been to several executions, and she writes several guys on the road.
She's one of those regular correspondents.
Yes.
Do we have a crowd out there?
Yes, we have about 25 of them out here. Manuel has an extended family. And, of course, we've got groups. We've got the faith group. We've got the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty here from Houston and from around this area. And then we've got Gloria's group here. And then we've got people just from the neighborhood.
Pretty regular crowd.
Regular crowd, yes, but we're glad to see everybody.
Sure, absolutely.
The crowds have grown over the years.
Pat, let's play like we've got some original listeners. Can you tell the audience what crossing the road means?
Once the witnesses cross the road, we know that the Supreme Court has issued a ruling that was not in Manuel's favor, and the execution will proceed. They'll go into a room, they'll be searched, and they'll go into the viewing room, and Manuel will be on the gurney with the IVs already in his veins, and the curtains will open. He will be able to see his witnesses. They will be able to see him, and that he will be able to give a last statement.
And so the execution process has begun. And before they even crossed the road, he was on the gurney and set up with the needles.
Yes, he was. Yes, the state of Texas is very careful about that. They don't want anything botched like Oklahoma. They're very crafty people. They know what they're doing.
Okay, is there anyone from Mr. Vasquez's family that would like to talk to us?
Yes, a cousin named Juan would like to say something. Here he is.
Okay.
Hello, this is Güero. Manuel Vasquez is cousin.
Yeah, Güero, go ahead.
I just want to give thanks to all the family on behalf of Manuel. He wants to give thanks to everybody that's out here and to everybody that's back there. Just keep your head up, man. God bless you and stay strong. And y'all got people that love you on here and here support you.
Thank you, Güero.
Gracias a todos. Adentro. Síganle fuerte. Que Dios los bendiga. Aquí estamos por ustedes.
Thank you for doing that in Spanish, and please tell the family on our behalf. We have that. They have our sympathy.
Appreciate you.
Thank you, Güero.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. There's a,
I'm back, Roy.
Okay, Pat, there's a good Hispanic nickname, Güero. Means light-skinned, and yeah.
Yes, he has an extended family, and we're very grateful. We all know that sometimes there is no family here, and we're very grateful that Manuel does.
Yeah, that and when we get disconnected, tell Widow that we appreciate his coming on the show and doing that.
Yes, it took a lot of him. Everybody is very emotional out here.
Okay, Pat. Unfortunately, you're going to call us later with bad news.
Yes, I am.
We love you.
Okay. See you later, Ray.
Thank you. Bye bye. And that was Pat Hartwell, who is our faithful reporter from New York. You can hang that line up, Dewey, before it starts beeping. And is anybody out there to hang that line up, Dewey? Okay, there you go. But at any rate, Pat's a loyal attendee there. Engineering tonight is Dewey of the Prison Show. I'll be a guest on the Prison Show this coming Friday. They gave me 15 minutes to come back and do a cameo, and I may have you guys on the road may be interested. I think I'll have Carrie Max Cook with me. There's a familiar voice for some of you. Jim, I'm getting to know a lot of people on death row.
We're going to know fewer after tonight.
Yeah, one few. No, I didn't get to interview this fellow.
You didn't.
We were scheduled for an interview, but he was off the unit when we went last Wednesday. What about this case?
Well, this case came out of San Antonio and involves the Mexican Mafia. What happened, Vasquez supposedly was a member of that group, and what they were doing in San Antonio, they have a deal they call a dime, and what that means is people that are selling drugs, they collect a 10% tax from them, kind of like a sales tax, and if they don't pay it, they do bad things to you. So
they got to have some kind of important, payback for people
right.
that don't follow the rules.
Well, you can't report them to the comptroller,
right.
You have to do something to them. So what happened, there was a lady that it was named Juanita Rivera, and she was dealing drugs, and she sifted them. She brushed them off on her 10% tax.
As a matter of fact, the action was called Brush Off the Dime.
That's right, called Brush Off the Dime is what they call it. Well, what happened, he told a group of people that are going to eliminate her, and the job was assigned to Vasquez to do it. And what happened, he and Vasquez and two more guys, one of them by the name of, let me get the names here, one of them was by the name of Lou John, and one was Johnny Joe Cruz. And they went to the motel where this woman was staying, and she knew the Mexican Mafia was after them, so she was hiding out. And she had a real good friend of hers with her hiding out in this motel. They go to the same motel, and that night, rather than doing the job they were supposed to do, they had some girls over, and they started doing heroin, doing drugs, and drinking alcohol and raising hell. So what happened the next morning, they got up the next morning, these three men, Ibarra, kind of the leader of the group, LeJohn, and this kid that was with them, this fairly young kid named Joe Cruz, they go to the hotel room where she's living and knock on the door, and the man answers the door, her boyfriend. He had a chain lock on it, and they break the chain lock in, and they're covered with have ski mask on their face and socks on their hands. They begin to beat him, and they beat him till he's unconscious, then they start beating on Ibarra. And what ended up finally happening is that Vasquez starts choking her at the telephone cord and choked her to death and killed her after they beat her up pretty badly. Then they tried to ransack the room to find valuables. And then they left. And, of course, when Ibarra came to, he recognized, in spite of the disguise, he recognized one of the three men. And he identified them, and that led to the arrest of all three of them. And so all three of them were arrested, and what happened during the trial, they filed capital murder cases on all three of them. So what happened during the trial when they were selecting the jury, they cut a deal with one of the defendants. They cut a deal with this young kid, Cruz, to testify against Vasquez. And so at trial, what they had the testimony of Vasquez. And Vasquez got a sweetheart deal because he ended up getting a charge of aggravated robbery and got a 7-year sentence.
That's the kid.
That's the kid.
Okay.
So he gets a 7-year sentence out of this. He testifies against Vasquez, and that's how they know all the details about who did what, and that's where it came from him. Of course, the boyfriend was also to identify some of the robbers, too. They had his testimony. Plus, when they arrested Vasquez, they found the bloody clothing in his car, and the bloody clothing had the DNA evidence from both victims of the beatings. They put him at the scene. So DNA put him at the scene. The kid named Cruz was the one that explained what he did. And, of course, Vasquez and the boyfriend explained what they did to him. And that's why he got convicted. So it's a pretty sudden.
So there are three defendants.
Yes.
One of them gets a death penalty, Vasquez.
Right.
Cruz gets a sweetheart deal. Seven years.
And the other defendant gets 35 years.
Gets 35 years.
Right. Because the one they were really after, and Susan will explain this more fully, the one they were really after was Vasquez, and Susan will explain why they were really after him.
Okay. Oh, Susan, you got the background.
Well, essentially he had a violent history, okay?
This ain't his first rodeo.
No, he had a violent history of some serious, pretty horrible violent crimes. So, and of course the state obviously brought that out at punishment. So at punishment, what the state had for his violent history was in 1986, he was involved in a murder of a man named Robert Alva. And he, along with his brother, when Robert Alva was killed, he apparently beat him with a belt, with a crowbar, kicked him, and they set him on fire. And I assume there were other people involved because Vasquez got a 10-year TDC sentence out of it. Okay, so he got his 10-year sentence. Then he also had a year probation for, extortion by threat or robbery by threat. And then they also had a 1992 execution style murder of another drug dealer.
No reason to think any of this is personal. It's all gang stuff.
You would think so. I mean,
it all looks like gang stuff. I mean, if you're going to describe how the gang does business, this is how the gang does business.
It appears to be the case that it was essentially a gang activity and drug dealing.
That second murder for certain, because it did the same thing. Yeah. He stiffed him on the dime, and that's why they got the second murder.
So yeah. Even though he had been convicted before, the same thing, he goes right back.
Right.
Seems to be a pattern developing.
Right.
And then he was apparently involved in a number of burglaries and unsolved robberies. And when he was in custody, he was placed in administrative segregation because he was violent and disruptive towards other, employees.
Well, the Mexican Mafia is actually a prison gang.
Well, anyway, he was placed in segregation because he was apparently violent and disruptive to the employees and other inmates.
Okay, Dewey's on the telephone. When he gets off the telephone, we've got a report from, I think, David Atwood coming in. But go ahead. This is a pretty colorful past.
And yes. It's pretty extensive. I mean, these are very violent crimes.
It's very violent crimes,
right.
And it follows a pattern that would be consistent with he's a loyal gang member doing the bidding of...
They're extremely violent crimes.
Yeah. Not only that, Ray, you also have the same thing. His father was doing a life sentence in TDC for murder, had a brother and cousin. All of them were in TDC. So, the apple doesn't fall from the tree.
You're
going to
have me concerned about Weto here.
Well, I don't know. Weto may be the only one that's not in trouble.
Bless his heart.
I mean, he's about the only one that's either not in jail. Because his father was doing a life sentence during all of this time. And he had a brother and a cousin. Both of whom were in the penitentiary, so... It wasn't just, him. He was pretty much most of the family, except perhaps Weto was the only one.
I hope so.
We had extended family, but a lot of them were TDC. So.
Yeah, right. And it gated community.
Right.
And that's kind of the way that goes. To our audience, we deal sometimes with some pretty ugly cases.
This is pretty ugly.
And this is not a pretty case.
No.
And it's a Bexar County case.
Right.
And Bexar County prosecutor has dealt with him before.
Oh, yeah, as a female that got the death penalty in this case, female prosecutor.
And there's that old Chuck Hurt theory that you actually don't go to prison for what you do. You go to prison because they get tired of messing around with you.
We got tired of killing people.
Yeah, and you keep coming back for the same thing. They just run out of options to do.
After your third or fourth killing, they get pretty cranky about it, you know.
Well, did all this come out in the trial, or did all this come out in the punishment phase?
Well, part came out in the trial, and the rest of it came out in the punishment phase. I mean, in the trial, they obviously had the testimony, you know.
Anything unusual about that? The jury out long?
No. The jury, this was a pretty, the real, what I admire is what the lawyers did on appeal, because they didn't have a whole lot to work with, because they got a co-defendant testifying, DNA evidence, they got an eyeball witness, they have that horrible record of multiple killings, and I admire what the lawyers did on appeal.
We got Dave. Hook him up. Dave?
I'm here.
Where are you?
We're in front of St. Stephen's Church, corner of Woodhead and West Alabama.
It's a little fresh out there.
Yeah, it is, but it's not too bad. It's not raining. That's a good thing. We've got a good, fairly good turnout. We've got, seven people here now. And that's not too bad for not a big group, but not too bad for a Wednesday, I guess I should say.
It's a good bit of traffic. You got enough light for them to see your signs?
Yeah, we have signs. We've got this big old banner that says stop executions. And then we have another sign that says kill the death penalty.
Okay.
We have another sign that says don't kill for me with a big needle with a cross, with a line through it. So
it looks like
very, very visible. Very visible.
Okay, Dave. News this week is that they've got execution juices for tonight and next week.
Right.
What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, the fact that we have any executions is a horrible statement for the state of Texas. And, we should be winding this thing down and just not having any. It's not accomplishing anything good for our state, for our society. I think it perpetuates a culture of death. And I just wish some of our politicians, including our governor, would wake up and smell the roses and say, hey, we don't have to do this anymore. We can have a better state for everybody. And we could also save a lot of money. But killing, this is the most premeditated kind of killing that you can imagine. An execution. It's the most cold-blooded, premeditated killing that could take place. And this is not anything a civilized society should be doing.
And the courts have ruled that if they find a new supplier, they will be identified.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Texas, with the mentality of some of the politicians in this state, they'll do anything to carry out an execution. And I hope they run out of those drugs. I hope that nobody else will supply them. But God knows what Texas would go to next, you know.
Well, Utah yesterday went to gun firing squad.
Well, that's not that.
Yeah,
the governor
right.
has to sign it. He hasn't.
Governor hasn't signed it into law, but it's passed the legislature.
Yeah, they'll try something else, you know. And the real key to all of this is to get better politicians in place, politicians who truly do have a respect for life, all life, and who do not just put out sound bites out there about being pro-life, but then they let the death sentences go on one right after another. And this is also a message to our current district attorney, who apparently is embracing the death penalty in a way like Johnny Holmes and Chuck Rosenthal. She's in that mold, apparently. She's not doing this city or this county or this state any good.
I was supposed to meet with her on the 24th, but I have a conflicting appointment with my eye doctor, so I'll put it off till next cycle.
Okay. All right, Ray. Well, I'm glad you're having that meeting.
Okay. Would you please give folks your organizational connection?
Okay. It's Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and the website is TCADP org. It'll give all the information there about how to contact us and what's going on in the future.
And you've got friends and allies out there on West Alabama in the cold and up in Huntsville tonight.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
More the merrier.
Thank you,
sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
And that was Dave Atwood, who is at the corner of West Alabama and Woodhead Street in front of an Episcopal church. Nice Catholic boy dealing with them Anglicans. Where do we go from here, Jim?
Well, as I said earlier, I really admire the appellate lawyers. And what always happens in cases like this, in spite of all the facts, all the dead people, it's always the lawyer's fault. So we have that problem, and I wanted Larry to discuss.
Isn't that built in?
Well, sort of.
Don't the appellate lawyers have to blame the trial lawyers to find a mistake?
Not really. You can do other things to do that. For example, I'd worked on a death penalty appeal, and I said the judge was at fault for the lawyer being incompetent because he didn't pay enough money for investigators.
Okay.
You can bypass that.
Okay.
And I asked Larry to kind of explain once again how that standard works, what we call the Strickland standard on ineffective assistance of counsel, because it's a real, real hard hill to climb.
Okay.
Okay, and as Jim mentioned, since Vasquez got the death penalty, his post-conviction lawyers have two paths they follow. One is the direct appeal, and the other would be the writ of habeas corpus. And the direct appeal is automatic. But in terms of using the ineffective assistance of counsel, that has to be developed, and it takes a while to develop that. So trying to do that through the motion for new trial and appellate process, you just don't really have the timetables are so short that it just makes sense to try to use the writ process, and that you have the time to get the trial transcript and so forth and find out what the lawyers even did.
Are those time constraints built into the process?
That's part of the law. I mean,
part of the law. In other words, you got a right to appeal, but you may not have time to prepare it.
Well, the direct appeal.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you've got, file a motion for new trial, present that motion to the court, get a hearing, and so forth. That's the period of days.
I mean, days.
We're talking about 10 days, 30 days, 75 days. The first writ was filed about 2 years later.
Okay.
So
let me explain the second one. Explain that. After the trial is over, you've got 30 days to file a motion for a new trial. You must put everything within your motion.
You've got to put everything in there that you're going to talk about.
In 30 days after the trial, and you can't amend it. You're stuck with that. That's why that motion for a new trial is not good, because you've only got 30 days to do a motion for a new trial. You can hear it within 75 days, but
you can't get the transcript in that period of time.
You can't prepare an effective point in 30 days.
So you're preparing a motion for a new trial off of your memory, what was going on when you were very busy in the courtroom.
More important, Ray, the new emphasis, and Larry's going to talk about this, the new emphasis, they call it the Wiggins case, is what the lawyer didn't do. And that's where the emphasis has gone now. Other than saying the lawyer was an idiot and made a mistake, they're saying he's lazy and didn't do his job. That's where the new emphasis is going. That's called a Wiggins problem as opposed to Strickland.
And in terms of the motion for new trial process, again, 30 days and so forth, you can't even figure out whether the lawyer was effective or ineffective. You don't even know what the lawyer did. You can't find that out in that shorter time frame.
Unless you were in the courtroom when it happened.
And even if you were, it's still going to be difficult to figure it all out. It's going to take a lot more strategy sessions than you can accomplish within a 30-day, 75-day time frame. So now we understand that. So in terms of your post-conviction remedies, if you are going to use the ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland, Strickland holds that, well, every person is entitled to a lawyer. Mm-hmm. The lawyer needs to be competent.
Yeah.
And so the first prong of Strickland says that if you find the lawyer's performance to be deficient, saying in essence that the counsel's performance fell below the standard of reasonableness. That's the first prong. And then the second thing is you've got to determine that the lawyers, but for that deficient performance, the result would have been different. In the guilt-innocence phase, would not have been found guilty of capital murder. You know, not guilty, not likely to happen, but lesser included, those kinds of things. And on the punishment phase, the death penalty would not have been assessed. That's a pretty strong burden. Yeah. But what the lawyers do, the post-conviction lawyers do, is they go through the entire transcript and try to figure out what the lawyers, the trial lawyers, did or failed to do that may have been deficient. Did this, should not have done that. Did not do this where he should have done it. And so they go through that. And Mike and Jack are going to talk about the specifics of what the claims were that the lawyers failed to do.
Well, the direct appeal has to do with what actually happened in the trial, the evidence that was admitted, and those kinds of issues. The writ, you've got a little more flexibility.
It's kind of a different process. The direct appeal is saying we know about some error. The writ is really a process of a person is being wrongly constrained, and so it's a directive to the person constraining them, saying that there is some reason as to why you are wrongly constraining them. So it gives you a lot more flexibility in terms of, you know, you produce the body and say, these we believe that you are constraining this person wrongly, and these are the reasons for it.
All writs fall under the habeas corpus theory. Where's the body?
Well, this particular, the kind of writ we're talking about right now is a writ of habeas corpus,
yeah.
Okay, which is what we're talking about, the restraining the body.
Okay.
Let me kind of explain the difference. In a direct appeal, you're restricted to what was brought up at trial.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's in a writ, you can go beyond that, but it's less effective because the only error you can bring up must be of constitutional dimension. Because in a direct appeal, if it's a statutory violation, a rule violation, a violation of prior case law, you could perhaps get a reversal. But in a writ, the reason you see so many Sixth Amendment issues, it must be a constitutional error. So you can develop other evidence that wasn't developed at trial, but you can only argue a constitutional error as opposed to an error in violating a statute.
So the writ constraints deal with the nature of the question
exactly.
You raise.
Exactly.
The direct appeal deals with the nature of a trial that has happened.
Absolutely.
That you don't have the transcript bar. You weren't there.
Right.
And you've got to figure out what this guy that
exactly.
was there did wrong.
And you got to pitch every argument in a writ on a constitutional basis. That's why you always see a Sixth Amendment claim, a due process claim, innocent claim. And that's why you see all of those. It must be a constitutional error you've got to allege.
Well, you remarked that you thought the appellate lawyers did some remarkable stuff.
Well, they didn't
here.
Have much to work with.
I know that. Well, I mean, I'm sitting here trying to find what they had to work
well,
with.
Well, Michael's going to talk about some of the stuff they tried to work with. I think Larry wants to add something.
And what they did, what they have to do, Ray, at this point, is if you're trying to point out what the trial lawyers did or did not or failed to do, you've got to, at the hearing, you need to bring in the witnesses. The primary witness you need to bring in are the lawyers, all the lawyers, in terms of what those lawyers did or did not do. Now, not all the lawyers were called at the hearing. And then other witnesses who perhaps may have been called or should have been at least investigated. You've got to prepare, allege that these witnesses were available and would have said these kinds of things. Now, the lawyers themselves who are called have to be given an opportunity to state whether what they did or did not do was part of their trial strategy. And those are the kinds of things that Mike and Jack are going to talk about, what those lawyers
okay, so while we're did. Transitioning from Larry to Michael from the other side, where does the lawyers come from? Can you tell from the record whether they were court-appointed lawyers or the public defenders?
Virtually all death penalty cases are court-appointed. These were the court-appointed lawyers. Had one female lawyer to begin with. She did a lot of the work, and she is substituted by two other lawyers. They'll always, in a death penalty case, appoint two lawyers.
Okay.
It's very rare because it costs a capital murder if you try it right.
And both of them really have got to be first chair qualified
lawyers.
That's
right. Yeah. Because the problem is in a capital murder case, you're talking about in a trial that lasts 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And you simply, most people can't leave their practice that long. It's too prohibitive cost-wise to hire somebody unless you're Cullen Davis. And, but in these cases, they're all always appointed. In this case, he had four lawyers involved to begin with, all total, and plus investigators that were appointed.
Mike, what'd you find?
Well, Larry started off my talk well, and what the allegations were was that the lawyer did not contact, interview, or call the witnesses. He gave an impressive list of 12 witnesses that he said would testify.
That he would have said that in opening arguments.
He would have, Mr. Vasquez felt that if the lawyers would have interviewed these witnesses, these 12 witnesses, and contacted them, interviewed them, and called them to court, they would have put facts in issue that would prove his innocence. Some of the facts he claimed they said he wanted the adjoining people at the motel room to prove the time of the murder. He also claimed that the other two co-defendants told some of these witnesses that he was not involved with it. He also had claimed that these witnesses would also say that he was not at the location at the time, and that after the murder, the two co-defendants came back from the murder and he wasn't there. Now, at first blush, if your co-defendants told people that he wasn't there, that seems like good witnesses. If the time is an issue, those are good witnesses. So on paper, he had 12 people who would say things that would indicate he might not have done it. The problem is once they got to the hearing, he didn't call any of them. Number one of the most important things, like Larry said, is these witnesses have to be able to say that they were available to trial. Well, of the 12 witnesses, only one said he was available for trial. In fact, of the 12 witnesses, only four were called at the hearing. So eight of them weren't even at the hearing to testify. Of the four that were at the hearing, only one said that he would be available to trial. The other situation is that he only called one of the lawyers. There were three lawyers on the case. He would have to prove every lawyer and what the lawyer didn't do. And the one lawyer that did testify, what he did say, is that he could not use the witnesses because the witnesses that he interviewed contradicted Mr. Vasquez's alibi witnesses, and it was contradictory testimony. So he could not use those witnesses. In addition, there were two investigators. Neither one of the investigators were called to the courtroom. Well, it's his duty to prove the lawyers did not do their job, and of the five people working on the case, three lawyers and two investigators, he called one lawyer, who was the last lawyer in the case, who didn't know much about anything else that happened before him.
Now, if the defense side got enough money from the court to hire investigators,
they hired two investigators.
Okay, and they did not testify in the trial.
He didn't call them. He didn't call him. He had the right to call him, but he didn't call him. He also did not call his first lawyer.
Well, I mean, I guess the only rationale for that is after he hired them and they went out and did an investigation, they didn't find anything that helped Vasquez.
Which is what the one lawyer testified is what they said was contradictory to his own, to their own testimony. So it's the defendant's burden to prove the lawyer did not do their job and he failed to prove it.
And so, in these kind of cases, the more we get into this, the more the circus-like atmosphere.
Well, it's even more than that. Once that lawyer said what I said, he said that I only talked to these witnesses and they contradicted it. Once he said it, it was the defendant's job to then state and refute what the lawyer's claim was to show the lawyer wasn't being honest. He didn't do that. So you put up a prima facie defense, the lawyer says it's not true, you got to show something to why the lawyer did not do his job right.
Well, certainly those co-defendants had, they had a horse in this race. Their passing the buck could have something to do with the outcome in their plea bargain deals.
It could be, but it was his job to come in with witnesses. And again, if the two co-defendants had told people that he wasn't even there, I would consider that to be relevant evidence. But he never got anybody to come to court to say that's what the co-defendant said. So somehow it looks like it was a shotgun approach of things that would work if the facts backed it up, but there was no witnesses to back up these facts.
I think we've got bad news coming in on the telephone. Dewey's going to check it out for us right now, and then we will proceed from here.
Ray, a lot of this is just common sense. You think about it for a moment. They could very well have told Vasquez and his family everything Vasquez claimed. Mm-hmm. Just like, for example, if a friend of yours shows a picture of a baby you think it's ugly, you're going to lie to him and say he's beautiful. But behind your back, when he...
Yep, hold on just a second. Are you there, Pat?
Yes, I am. The media witnesses are walking out, and we're expecting Manuel's family and friends to walk out in just a second.
Well, please give our regards. Sorry that you're bringing me bad news, but please give our regards to the vigilance there.
Yeah, they really appreciate it, and his family really appreciates that everyone was here, and that's all I can say. I'll see you next week when Randall.
I hope not, but if it looks like that's going forward too, so it'll be next week with Randall.
Yes, it will.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. See you later. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Jack, you got it. Whoops. Well, I can't. Dewey, my buttons are not working. There you go. Jack, what you got?
Well, Vasquez made a whole bunch of claims on this ineffective counsel. You know, he made a whole bunch of, he basically threw the kitchen sink. And, you know, for good reason. I mean, for crying out loud.
Okay, when you say Vasquez, do you mean his appellate lawyers?
His appellate lawyers, okay. His appellate lawyers threw the kitchen sink at everything, you know, at this. They came up with things that, frankly, I mean, they're questionable at best. Among the things that they were talking about is that one of the things that they objected to as far as in their ineffective assistance claim was that at trial, the defense counsel failed to voir dire the jurors regarding the accomplice witness rule. Now, you know, this is important because when you pick a jury, you have to keep in mind what's going to end up on the jury charge. One of the issues that this case would bring up is the accomplice witness rule. And the accomplice witness rule, for those listening who don't know it, is that if one of the witnesses that you're relying upon to get a conviction is an accomplice,
mm-hmm.
you have to have some other kind of corroborating
sure.
evidence.
That's true of almost all state courts. It was not true in the Rosenberg case.
Didn't know that.
It's never been true in federal court.
It's never been true in federal court.
Hmm. Yeah. So, the idea is that, if you have Cruz here who's testifying. He's an accomplice witness. You have to have some other kind of
corroborating
evidence. Mm-hmm. And so, on appeal, Velasquez says, well, you know, this was a question that was a relevant question that should have been asked of the jury panel. And the Court of Appeals looked at it and said, well, that's nice, but by the time the trial court was already picking a jury, they had already picked 9 jurors before the defense knew that that Cruz was going to testify, that this accomplice witness rule might be relevant. Now,
wait a minute. Would you raise that in voir dire?
Well, I would, because it's eventually going to be on your jury charge.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so they didn't have the information they needed.
Defense did not have the information they needed, probably because they were probably sweating out Cruz. Hey, Cruz, we're going to give you, you know, this is pure speculation on my part.
Sure, I understand. Everybody's playing, let's make a deal.
Right. That's exactly right.
It's like a used car dealership where you have competing salesperson.
And then let's see which one, which car has the transmission that falls
out. But the
out.
Defense don't have anything to offer him, only the prosecution.
That's right. A little bit of a stack deck.
Yeah.
So the defense doesn't find out that Cruz is going to testify until 9 of the jurors are already picked. Well, at this point, defense comes back and says, hey, judge, we need to go back and voir dire the 9 jurors who've already been chosen. And the trial court says, that's nice, but too bad. We're not going to let you do that. That's correct.
Okay. It's Wednesday. I've got to go play golf.
Anyways, there's really not, there really wasn't much on appeal that that Velasquez could have said. The trial team did everything they could. They went so far as to suggest to the jurors that, look, you know, that for them to use Cruz as a witness, I mean, it's an act of desperation. They have no other real evidence. And frankly,
do you think the court allowed them to do that argument?
I'm sorry?
Did you think the court allowed them to do that argument?
To do which, the argument?
To go to the jury after they've already been vaudired and say, wait a minute, we skipped something back here.
Well, I mean, the trial court, wasn't going to let the defense go back, and re-voir dire the
people. I know, but they could argue it. They
sure.
just couldn't re-voir dire it.
That's right. And as I understand, the defense did in fact go back and say, hey, you know, this was an issue
should have been brought to your attention.
I don't know if they came back and said that it should be brought to your attention, but they did say, look, Cruz, this whole thing of Cruz.
Well, why doesn't this become reversible error at this point?
It's the but-for test. If things had gone completely your way, would this have changed the outcome? And on appeal, you have to demonstrate that if things went our way, there is no question that we would have won.
Okay.
And this is not the case here.
It really isn't.
You know, Velasquez argued a lot of things, and frankly, they were little tiny details that frankly didn't get to a not guilty. It didn't get to something that you could really sink your teeth into. And I think that's one of the issues that I think a lot of.
No, I get it. And Vasquez apparently was very active in his own defense, wouldn't you say?
Probably so. He'd been down that road
before.
He'd been there before.
Yeah. He's not a novice, you know, and he'd lucked out sometime before, got a 10-year sentence for a similar case.
My experience with defendants is that there's this impression that if a little bit is wrong, well, then the whole case should be thrown out.
And especially if that gets reinforced, where you're up for a homicide and you wind up with a 10-year sentence, well, you know, I got the slick here.
Right.
Here's your problem. Jack mentioned it. You can't just show an error. You got to show that the error harmed you. Well, you got to show it harmed you.
Yeah.
And the problem is really the only thing Cruz added were the details of the murder, because they had already had the DNA evidence tied to the scene, and they had the other witness who was not an accomplice who identified the robbers. So they had that evidence.
They had the corroborating evidence.
There's no way they could say that failure to have voir dire them on the accomplice witness was harmful. And
that would not have changed the outcome because they had the pieces together.
Give you a good example. When that first came out, there was a case in federal court on a check-kiting scheme that took the government like 3 years to put together.
Yeah.
They appointed a lawyer who had never tried a case before. And they put him to trial, and he just got murdered. And they said, I don't care if you'd hired half the world. There's so much overwhelming evidence. I don't care who you hired. The result would have been the same. And that's that but-for test we're talking about. And this was such a heinous crime, and there's no way in the world they could show prejudice in this case, because Jack had touched on that.
Yeah. I mean, on appeal, they even said, well, defense should have stopped the mentioning that he was that Velasquez was a member of the Mexican Mafia. Well, eventually, the facts were going to show that he was part of the Mexican Mafia. There was going to be some mention of it. I mean, for crying out loud,
I understand there were visible tattoos on some people around there.
It was intrinsic to the motivation of the killings.
Yeah. Sure.
I mean, that was exactly the motivation of the killings.
Yeah, they couldn't keep, don't beat the table, but they couldn't, they couldn't
unicorns
keep,
don't
they,
beat
they
the
couldn't
table,
keep,
Susan.
They couldn't keep that out of the evidence, because it was intrinsic.
Well, then afterwards, after the murder, Velasquez goes to, you know, take shelter with Mexican Mafia folks.
Sure. All right. And apparently did some of that work while he was incarcerated.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else got any tidying work, or have I got a 15-minute editorial to do here?
Well, I thought one of the more interesting things, and I thought the jury argument that the prosecutor made was kind of out of outlandish. Didn't you, Jack, the argument that remember what the DA argued in this case?
Which part?
I'm talking about dangerous. On the punishment part. He's the most dangerous man that ever walked into the face of the earth.
That's, you know.
Well, just walked into the courtroom in San Antonio.
Yeah, right.
Well, I don't know. I've been in courtrooms in San Antonio in jailhouse jumpsuits. So.
Hyperbole is not one of those things that...
But you know, it's used a lot in the practice of criminal law.
Sure, of course.
Sure.
But see, here's the thing that a lot of folks don't realize. And I realize in appellate work, you've got to do everything you possibly can do. But what happens, this always claiming the lawyers at fault when there's really no basis for it. Like in this case, they were straining at a gnat to try to prove the lawyer made a mistake.
They were really straining.
And so what happens when for example, number one, you put your heart and soul in trying to defend somebody. And then you work real hard on the case. And then the next years and years after that, you got to go to affidavits, go to courts, be raked over the coals for what you did and didn't do. And what's this done? We've got a lot of real fine lawyers who refuse to take appointments. And they don't want to put up. Because I've often said when you're trying a death penalty case, you got two people to watch out for. The state's evidence and writ lawyers. Because the problem is, and there's a movement among a lot of death penalty people that because their end is justified, they can make any means to get there. And oftentimes they literally lie about things they claim the lawyer has done before. I mean, there's been some outrageous claims made against lawyers that had no basis in fact.
Yeah, but that's an occupational hazard.
But you don't. What happens if you're doing death penalty cases is driving a lot of good lawyers away from it. They don't want to put up with it anymore.
It's an occupational hazard only if you accept those kinds of cases.
You can't take a thick skin to it and say,
well, a whole bunch of lawyers.
This is the way the game is played.
A whole bunch of them are quitting doing death penalty cases now.
That's a shame.
Well, they're doing it because they get sick and tired of being raked over the coals, and they're not going to do them anymore. They say, I've quit. I'm not going to do them ever again. And a lot of good lawyers are doing that now. And that's the negative part of the attacking lawyers on appeal, is that they just don't want to put up with a whole bunch of people.
What's an appellate lawyer going to do?
Oh, there's
except
a way.
Go there.
You can frame it differently. Like, I'm giving an example. I remember the guy that killed the alley theater lady?
Yeah.
Okay, Ron Mock is the one that tried that
Ron
case.
Mock.
And Ron did some things that probably shouldn't have done in that trial or didn't do some things he shouldn't have done.
Well, he had to run the bar.
Well, the problem was they didn't give him enough money to have a good investigator because this guy, after he did the killing, went to California, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that Ron could have investigated. They wouldn't give him enough money. So I ended up doing the writ, and what I did, rather than attacking Ron Mock, I attacked the judge. I said the judge was not giving him the adequate funds to hire a good investigator.
Sure.
He rendered Ron ineffective.
How did that work?
Well, it worked better than attacking Ron. Neither one would have worked.
Yeah, okay.
But
okay.
I'm telling you,
you found yourself in that situation.
Of course.
I don't care what I do, this is going to be the
outcome.
Of
but I knew that I could attack Ron on appeal, but I took a different path. I attacked the judge for not giving him the tools to work with. And at least that, you could say the same thing. Ron didn't do this, didn't do this, didn't do that. And the reason he didn't, because the judge didn't give him the money to hire an investigator. So I think there's a different way to go about doing that. And something else I think writ lawyers should do, and I've tried to encourage this, if you're going to attack a lawyer, at least be a gentleman about it and talk to him ahead of time.
Sure.
Looky. Let me give you an example. There was a real fine lawyer here in town that overlooked a confession. What had happened, the guy had been unlawfully arrested and a confession was given. He overlooked the unlawful arrest. And I was doing the appeal. And I know the lawyer real well. Before I did that point of error, I called him up. Mm-hmm. And I said, looky, I've got the transcript. Let me tell you what I think the problem is. The problem is you attack the confession as being coerced. What you should have done is looked at the arrest warrant because the arrest warrant was invalid. If the arrest warrant is invalid, the fruit of that invalid arrest would be the confession.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down with him and visited him about what I thought was wrong about the case. And he said, my God, you're absolutely right. I was wrong for not taking that approach. And go ahead and do what you need to do.
Okay.
Now, I think if they would do
if
that.
If you handle it that kind of
way. If you handle it that way and try to figure out a way to divert it to the judge, I'm a great believer in blaming the judge, not the lawyers for most of these instances.
And let me follow up on what Jim said. You know, if you attack the lawyer for, if you're going to lose on the appeal anyways, or there's an excellent chance you're going to lose on the appeal anyways, when you attack the system, at least you're getting some kind of traction. At least you're bringing up something that is novel, that's interesting. And if the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to ignore that, well, let's, you know, let it out. Let's bring it out into the open that the, you know, the, that the Court of Appeals may not care about whether they fund, they properly fund investigators on indigent cases. Things like that. At least you get a new message out there.
Get the issue out there.
Exactly.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm about rubbing the cat hair the wrong direction and questioning what the government does. Just read my cases. That's all there.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm going to take a few minutes. I'm going to take a few minutes here because, we come in here, and you can tell how hard the lawyers work, and this program would not even be a shadow of itself if these folks didn't put hours of work in preparation. My job is somewhat easier. But I anguish over Manuel. When I went to visit Manuel last week, he was off the unit, so I didn't get to interview him, so we're not going to have an interview with him to talk about. And I'm sorry that happened, because I would have loved to have talked about him. One of the things I did after I got out of prison is I worked for a good many years to get the grad program put into prison. Grad program is an escape clause where you can disassociate yourself from prison gangs and get out of solitary confinement. So when your mama visits or your wife or your kids visit, you can have a contact visit and you can talk to them on the telephone when we got those installed. I believe in the grad program. And I know there are convicts listening to this show and guys on death row listening to this show. I wish I could have had a conversation with Juan not while he was awaiting to get executed, but when he was 12 or 14 years old. Gangs are not tough guys hanging together, fellas. They never were, they never will be. Gangs are weak people being manipulated by cowards. The order to kill this woman actually came from higher up than Juan. I mean, than Mr. Vasquez. And he just did the dirty work. He gets to be the weak person this time. Somebody else gets to be the coward. But even if you're a weak person for 10 or 12 years and you graduate on up the gang lane, then you get to be a coward. I don't think that has a lot of appeal to anybody, especially convicts who think they're tough guys hanging together. Well, gangs ain't tough guys hanging together. And whenever I pitched that to the prison system, they said, oh, this is blood in, blood out. People are going to be dead if they try to reject the gangs. That didn't happen. Happened one time. We've had over 9,800 people processed out of prison gangs and out of solitary confinement and into general population. We had one case that actually drew blood. And he had enough of it, and he was big enough to handle it, and he survived it. His name's Rios. I know him well. He's a good guy. Big old wuss now. He had been the chairman of the Texas Syndicate. I'm not just talking through my hat. This is Ray Hill. I know what the hell I'm talking about here. And if you're sitting in solitary confinement for gang affiliation, get into grad. Get your ass out of there. Get into general population. Get you a job in the kitchen washing pots and pans. And when your family visits, you can have a contact visit. And you can go to the telephone every afternoon, call them, tell them how you're doing. They can afford to pay for the call. Execution Watch is an appeal to stop state killing in every case. Who I did get to visit last Wednesday was Robert Pruitt. Hi, Robert. I know you're listening. First time I visited Robert Pruitt, he was pale as a sheet. He was almost quivering in fear because he didn't have any hope and didn't have any place to go for hope. And he actually told me when I first got this death sentence, I thought it was my way out of here. Because he had only known since he'd been in prison, since he was a teenager, a life of terrible abuse and shame. I visited him last Wednesday. His color was good. His eyes were bright. We spent a lot of time laughing on the new interview. I hope I never get to play an interview with Robert Pruitt because I really don't think he did it. I don't think his lawyer thinks he did it. And I think he's got the qualified lawyer that can help him through the woods if the court will stop messing with his lawyer, and that's David Dow. You get to know both the lawyers and the inmates. I mean, that's the nature of this job. If he does survive, I'm going to sit down and talk to him about turning into radio and television those two interviews.
You know David's been suspended with the Court of Criminal Appeals for a year.
I know he's been suspended with David Court of Criminal Hill, but he can wire around that.
I hope so.
And David's a good lawyer. And he got suspended because he pointed out the weaknesses of the court, and that happens to be politics.
Well, it's more than that, Ray. Years ago, Kathy Cochran had written a big law review article about the state ought to have states' rights, and he just nailed her on a law review article out of the Yale Law Review and out of the University of Houston Law Review. She hated his guts because he made a fool out of her, and she pretty well poisoned the rest of the court against David. So it goes back.
Yep, it goes back, and that's the nature of being a lawyer. It's the nature of being a judge. Is you get drunk on that gown. But I don't want to do another Execution Watch show. I'm with Dave Atwood. I hope they don't find any more drugs, and I hope Texas legislature won't pass a law that'll lets them shoot people, and I hope the Supreme Court will look at all of this and say it's cruel and it's getting more and more unusual every day, and that will be the end of it. My name is Ray Hill. I want to thank the lawyers, Jim Skelton, Mike Gillespie, Larry Douglas, Susan Ashley, and what's this guy's name over here? Jack Lee, and I want to thank, we got an audience in the studio. I want to thank Elizabeth Stein for doing all the work. I want to thank our engineer, Dewey. The music we play.
Mike Schofer, don't forget his wife.
Okay.
But Mike wouldn't be here if it wasn't for his wife, so don't forget her.
And Mike's health is improving every day, and we hope that works out. My name is Ray Hill. We're due to come back next week. They're going to kill another guy, Philip and them, Randall Mays. Talk to you later.